This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. I'm Dick Beyer, and you are with the LeanConstructionBlog.com podcast. This is episode number 23, and it's the first one of the year in 2023. So it kind of coincidence? I don't know, perhaps. But we're really fortunate today to have a good friend and an unbelievable pioneer in all that we have done in the lean world. Let me introduce Iris Tomaline from the University of California at Berkeley. Hi, Iris.
Hey, Dick. How are you? Good morning.
I'm good. Thank you. I'm going to get you on the speaker view here so that everybody can see you. Calling you a pioneer is almost too tame of a word. I mean, you've been with Lean since the very beginning, and you're a founding member, I think, of IGLC and founding member of really the Lean Construction Institute. You're one of Todd Zabel's favorite people. So that's always a great recommendation in my book. And I think people are really interested in how you started in this industry and how you got to Berkeley. And then there's a whole number of people in our community that you have been the major influence for. So let's spend the next hour and chat about that. Does that sound good?
Sounds perfect. Yes, I'm ready.
All right. You're originally from Belgium, I think. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
Like my favorite detective, Hercule Poirot.
Yes. It's interesting.
So tell us a little bit about your early life and education.
And I appreciate you. You gave me that question in email because it gave me some time to reflect actually on something I hadn't thought about so much in recent years. But I was born and raised in Brussels. And then the next question people ask usually, so you speak French? The answer is no, I speak Flemish. But I am, Belgium is a very interesting country, small country, 11.5 million people, more or less in this day and age. We have three national languages, and they are Flemish, French, and German. So English is not one of them. And we are a very pluralistic country for many, many, many reasons. It would be a whole other podcast to just talk about all the intricate and bizarre situations that we have in Belgium. But long story short, I was raised in a secular humanist family, and I'm still a secular humanist. The main upbringing that I had at university level, should rephrase that. As a secular humanist, I went to the Free University of Brussels, the Flemish-speaking one, not the French-speaking one. And the Free University of Brussels has many people that very much like to quote French philosopher Henri Poincaré, and I should read his statement about thinking. Says, thinking must never submit itself neither to a dogma nor to a party, nor to a passion, nor to an interest, nor to a preconceived idea, nor to anything whatsoever, except to the facts themselves, because for it to submit to anything else would be the end of our existence.
Wow, that's powerful today, especially, isn't it?
It is a very powerful statement, and of course, a little paradoxical in and of its own as well, which makes it even more interesting to think about. But I think that philosophy very much framed my thinking, and I mention it because I think so much of the thinking resonates very well with lean thinking and with the scientific approach that we have to management of our project production systems today.
So what was there about growing up in Brussels that's influenced you? You know, we talk about heuristic biases and things that people grow up with, and they look left and they look right, and they see different things. Any any influence from being Belgium and then teaching in the States and working? You've worked all over the world, so you're not limited to, you know, one continent for sure.
Yeah, I think the main thing is Belgium is a very eclectic country. Many people for many different reasons, right? Of course, for many different regions, in part because it's the heart of the European community. And in part because it's a very small country and in and of its own, it actually does not have much power. And so it has to form coalitions with other countries gain strength by unity.
Perfect. Yeah. And unity and collaboration. It has been at the crossroads of so many, centuries of European conflict have always ended up somehow going through or touching Belgium as it sat there. So it's been a unique and important country.
Yeah. It's been called the battlefield of Europe.
Okay.
Sadly enough.
Yeah, thank goodness you weren't there when those terrible things were going on, I hope. How did you get into construction? What was what led you to that? Or did you not really get into construction? You got into design or engineering or something not construction?
So when I went to the Free University of Brussels, I actually started, I was the first cohort of students that entered into a program called architectural engineering. But it was very much housed in the College of Engineering and very much tied to the civil engineering department. So we got some courses in architecture, but I also got a very strong, more traditional civil engineering background. It was part of a 5-year civil engineering program. And at the end of my fourth year, I had the great fortune to be able to participate in an exchange program. There's a program called IESTE, the International Association for the Exchange of Students for Technical Experience. It's a wonderful organization. The idea is the local university finds industry opportunities for students that would come from other places. And then the students from the university that finds these spots gets their students to participate in the program as well. I applied to go to the United States at the time and was fortunate to get a position. I ended up spending a summer working for the Whites Company in Des Moines, Iowa.
Wow.
And the Whites is a, you know, terrific, terrific company to work for. They were very welcoming and I learned, feel like, an infinite amount about construction. I worked for a wonderful project manager who would basically let me tag along to everywhere he went. And then there were other student interns that I learned so much from. It was really a great experience. And that was what got me so interested in construction as opposed to the more civil engineering design and the things, or the architectural design and the things. So then the next year I applied for scholarships, and I had the great fortune to get a scholarship of the Belgian American Educational Foundation. And that allowed me to go to the United States for a master's degree program. And I was lucky to be admitted to Stanford University and ended up doing a master's there and then in the construction engineering and management program. And while there, Professor Ray Levitt had just returned from a sabbatical looking at the use of artificial intelligence and expert systems in construction. And he needed students to get launched on this research area. And so he recruited me. And then I ended up spending another 4 years at Stanford University working at this intersection of artificial intelligence and civil engineering construction project management, working on an artificial intelligence rule-based system to help with the layout of temporary facilities on construction sites.
Wow. Interesting. So Greg Howell was a Stanford guy. Did you run into him there or did you run into him later?
Yes, no, I ran into Greg. Greg would come by, he was very diligent. He would come by at very regular times, kind of check in what was to hear what was humming, you know, at Stanford, what the ideas were. And he was always very, very interesting to talk to as well. Yeah, and another person I ran into was actually quite influential is Vic Sanvito, now, of course, at Southland.
Yeah.
We just passed each other. He had just graduated as I arrived.
Yeah, I was just going to raise that because one of his favorite photographs is when he's like 20 years old at Stanford and Henry is there, and Greg is there,
and all Henry of these
folks are there. Yeah. So, when you were talking about architectural engineering, I thought of Victor right off the bat because he was he had taught in that architecture and engineering school at Penn State, and it turned out Mark Concher and Devin Mace and lots of PhDs.
Riley. That's right.
Yeah, and much like your journey where you've turned out lots of these PhDs. So did you end up getting your PhD at Stanford?
I did. I got, I did my master's in construction engineering and management. And then as I was working on my PhD, I also got a master's in computer science and artificial intelligence. And then in 89, I graduated with a PhD in civil engineering.
Did you ever run into Fernando?
Fernando Flores?
Flores?
Not at the time, but he lives in Berkeley, and I have met him here, of course, in recent years.
Oh, interesting, because he had when he came back from Chile. I mean, he's known in our community as the founder of the action language, or certainly some large part of it. But a large part of his study was around computers and artificial intelligence and things like that, wasn't it?
That is right. That is right. Yeah. With Terry Winograd in computer science. That is right. Yeah, his thesis was on how work gets done in the office. It's actually quite interesting thesis.
Yeah. Wow.
So but he worked here at UC Berkeley with the philosophy professor as well.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
So after Stanford, did you go out into industry or did you end up at Berkeley right away?
No, I actually became an assistant professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor in their construction engineering and management program.
And that's a beautiful place.
It's a great place. it's a very nice place. And this is a little bit of an aside, but I could say my older son now is a master's student at the University of Michigan in robotics. So it's kind of funny how things.
Oh yeah.
Come around.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, there's so many coincidences in the world. As a matter of fact, I think I first met you in a white corporate boardroom in Denver at an LCI board meeting. So the whites connection was good. It's funny that you got there. All right. So you're at the University of Michigan. You're in a beautiful place in the Midwest, probably felt very much like home.
Great university. A vibrant place, both culturally as well as academically. A really, really, really superb place. And I had a great group of colleagues to support the construction engineering and management program as well. So it was really a good place to be. My work there, though, my research there kind of transitioned from looking at site layout and how to solve that problem to kind of the more fundamental questions, as in, how do we know how much material we really need on a construction site? And when do we want it to be there? So I kind of transitioned from the layout problem more into the materials management problem, and then later on more into the supply chain management problem, so the broader systems view on what needed to be done. So it was it was an interesting time to be posing these questions, because even during my PhD dissertation research work, I was trying to understand how people do site layout, and it turns out there are very few academic publications that talk about site layout. The project management literature very largely ignores the problem of space planning. In fact, it's not mentioned as one of the five resources, materials, manpower, machines, time, and money. Space is usually left out.
Yeah, it's obviously quintessentially important where you put the building, because it has it has ramifications on the size of the building, how the building operates, all the rest of that stuff.
So I was going to say, especially at the project management level, you can pretend that it doesn't exist, but of course, when at the production level, as we say it, where the boots meet the ground, space is super important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Especially since we don't know an awful lot about what's happening under the ground when we run into on a regular basis. It's in the sustainability conversation these days, it's how you face the building and what's on the north side, what's on the south side. All of that's really, really important.
Yeah.
To what we're doing. So that's cool. And you, what sounded probably at the time somewhat arcane supply chain and things like that is super important these days as well. I'm seeing people on construction projects who think that they actually need a logistics strategy, mm-hmm. and almost a logistician to coordinate how they get things in a very uncertain market, where they put them, how they get them to the site, you know, all is risk mitigation for.
And now we have, of course, wonderful tools to help with that as well, right? Building information modeling, all the 3D representations are didn't exist, you know, or barely existed in the early 1990s. And nowadays they're easy to come by and easy to use, and they become increasingly powerful. So it's very nice to see how the technology is really helping us do our jobs better.
Yeah, I think that the one of the things I see, especially in Canada, is how underused building modeling and information modeling is, because it seems so powerful to me. And it seems like it's where everything should start. Everything should be built from that premise. And yet in Canada, we see a lot of BIM being taken out somewhere and turned into 2D drawings so that people could build mm-hmm. from 2D drawings. And it's like, whoa, we need to get fired up here. So you're at the University of Michigan, and then from there, did you go to Berkeley, or did you have a transitory stop in between?
Yes. So as an academic, we are allowed to go on sabbaticals. And so as part of my sort of realization that so little had been really written about materials management and site layout, I found at the time the best company to work with to learn about materials management. So the Construction Industry Institute had done a report several years before with kind of highlighting the computer-based materials management system of H.B. Zachary. And I thought, if I'm going to learn about materials management, I really need to learn about how that system works, what it does and doesn't do. So I had the good fortune then to reach out to H.B. Zachary, and their manager of material management, Jim Goodwin, suggested that I come join him on a large project site, a $1 billion project site in beautiful Pasadena, Texas.
This doesn't look like home. You know, hey, Dorothy, we're not in Brussels anymore, right?
It's the American experience. You got to go.
It is, for sure.
Interesting work is happening. it was one of these EPC type contracts where, the engineering firm had done a lot of engineering work and a lot of procurement of all the big materials, the more engineer to order materials, and then of course had put in estimates for all the commodity materials. And as Jim, as the contractor, then was seconded to the construction site, of course there's a lot of attention paid to all the engineer to order materials, and you just assume that you have enough of the commodities, but the commodities were estimates, and you know, estimates like plans are forecasts are always wrong.
Right.
And so Jim ended up spending a lot of time just procuring stuff. So that was kind of a big eye opener for me, that I realized it's like, well, why didn't get the numbers right? Why should we be doing all this so late? The other thing that really surprised me at the time was the whole practice of what's called trial allocation is, you know, the foreman would check in the computer system like the day before whether all the materials that they need for the crew would be available. And oftentimes there were shortages, and so there was some competition between crews as to who was actually going to get the materials. And of course, that's not a great way of getting work done, as you need everything that you need. So I, at the time, actually, my interest was in the use of barcoding and laser-based positioning systems in site layout. So that's actually how I got there. And I did a study on laser-based systems and barcoding to try to improve the actual management of materials on site. So materials that would be there sometimes 3 months, 4 months, 5 months long, man. Which, you know, in Houston, you know, sunning in the beautiful Houston sun is not the greatest. And of course, as happens, then they get damaged, they get lost, and so forth.
Right.
So Long story short, it was a great experience, but I came back with more questions, you know, than I had going in. Although I learned a lot, and then as I went back, I should have mentioned this did not end up being a sabbatical. I actually left the University of Michigan before I could take my sabbatical, but I took a year off because I was so eager to go, you know, be out on a construction site and learn from the best, what was happening. So after that year, the reason why I left University of Michigan is I had actually accepted a job at UC Berkeley. So I joined the faculty at UC Berkeley in 1996, and I had lunch at our favorite Japanese restaurants with Glenn Ballard, who was a lecturer at the time. And I was commiserating, I guess, with Glenn about the state of practice, about so many materials being in inventory and laid on yards for so long, and why should this be, and why can't people get it right? And Glenn at that time introduced me to the last planner system. And of course, at that lunchtime, kind of things clicked in my head.
Right. And so wow.
I was very fortunate that we had that lunch, and I've been a collaborator with Glenn ever since.
So, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's always hard to know who's driving the train, but it seems like you've always been a little more on the academic side, and Glenn's been a little more on the let's get this out in the field side. Is that fair, or is it mischaracterization?
Well, I have maybe moved from academia a little bit more to the field. Glenn, of course, started in the field as a pipe fitter and foreman, and then productivity improvement consultant. And he became more of an academic. In fact, he did his PhD in 2000, in part to kind of formalize the thinking around the last planning system. So it's been a very nice, you know, bringing together of ideas and testing the more theoretical ideas against practice.
Yeah, well, it's certainly one of the strongest collaborations in our community, and we've all benefited from it. So thank you for that. So you were involved with that. So Glenn started talking about Lean, I guess, at the same time that he was talking about the last planner system and that, or had you been involved in the Lean movement before that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So actually, I was not in the International Group for Lean Construction when it started in 1993. Mm. Although I kind of knew about it because I had heard some papers and met Laurie Koskela at the time, who of course was the driver. So Laurie Koskela, Glenn Ballard, Greg Howell, Luis Alarcón. There may have been other people there. I wasn't there in 1993 when the IGLC was founded. But what was interesting about the early 1990s is just that a number of people, including myself, sort of came to this understanding of industry where we knew that the existing systems were not performing as we wanted them to. And unfortunately, today, that's still the case, right? Too many projects are late, too many projects are over budget.
Right.
So we were looking at other things. So as I already mentioned, Dick, on my end, my big kind of aha was, it's like, well, people in project management talk about these five resources. They don't talk about space. If you don't even talk about space, how can you manage space? And if you don't manage space, you might be running into problems. And therefore, you know, what should we be doing to manage space, right? So Laurie Koskela, So Glenn Ballard sort of came to a similar realization, which is, you know, as a foreman, I want to do work, I want to do good work, but I'm basically impeded from doing good work because I don't get the right instructions, I don't get the right materials, I don't have the right place to work. Therefore, what can I do about it, right? And that's really what gave birth to the last planner system. Laurie Koskela came at it from a more academic end, but also very much with the systems, the larger systems view. So he looked at the different bodies of knowledge in the literature, in operations management, in project management, and he brought those together. And the prevailing perspective from a project management perspective, still today very much present in the Project Management Institute body of knowledge, is a transformation view, as in you have to transform inputs into outputs, and you should do that as well as you can. And if we do every task as well as we can, we assume that the project will be performed as well as we can. And the reality is, of course, that is not true, because the tasks are not independent of one another, right?
Right.
If you treat them as independent, you break dependencies, and therefore the local optimization solutions are really not necessarily going together at a higher level. So Laurie brought together this transformation view perspective and said what we really need to add to it is a flow view on production. And the flow view of production in the literature is captured by queuing theory, by what we do with simulation. And then on top of that, he also said, well, but what good is it to do transformation? What good is it to be good at doing transformation, doing it fast, if there is no customer who wants it, right? So the third perspective is the value perspective. So it's those different, incongruencies, I guess, that we all realized that kind of brought us together and sort of said, well, we know things are missing. Let's go figure out together what we can do to fill in the missing pieces. And, we're still working on that. There's still missing pieces, but I think we've come a long way.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you certainly have come a long way. I mean, I remember that very famous paper of Laurie's when he was talking about those things, and he had gone back to Schuhart and he'd gone back to all these, production managers in the 30s and had said, these guys were beginning to think about this in the right way. And then something, got us off track. I remember another article that he had about really whether we should be calling this lean or not, whether there was a there about whether the values that were, or the principles that were trying to be enunciated around what was a lean construction kind of conversation were very loose from Womack and Jones. And he was, as the disciplined guy that he is, skeptical about whether there were principles around it. Did you ever struggle with that same kind of idea that calling this lean construction was maybe not the right thing to do?
Yeah, the challenge with any word, of course, is that there are many interpretations for it. And unfortunately, or fortunately, right, the value of words is that they're concise, but there can be a lot of meaning given to any term. And I think the same has happened with lean. I think Laurie, who's also one of my collaborators, I have the fortune to collaborate with, as we speak, so to speak, on Zoom meetings.
Lots of smart people.
Let me think here. I lost my train of thought.
Oh, I'm sorry. I threw off. Really, the value of the word lean as a
Word lean. Yeah, so the problem with the value of the word lean is that it's only a single word. And of course, there's many meanings associated with it. And as anyone learns, a new language, and as I mentioned, I speak several languages. As anyone learns a new language, you always start with a very narrow understanding of the term. And then later through, reading more, you really begin to understand nuances and distinctions between words. And I think that's a challenge that we have with lean, is that people who are new to it try to kind of box it into a specific understanding that they have at the time that they become familiar with the term. And then they begin to see that there are other aspects that would need to be addressed. And then they say, well, but that's not lean. Whereas, in reality, other people might think that it is lean. So anyway, this gets us into a sort of a discussion almost about religion, right? Is it this or is it that? And I try to shy away from it. So I try to be very agnostic about the use of the term. I'm happy to call it lean if you want to call it lean. And if you want to call it something else, I'm happy to call it something else as well.
So this is part of your secular humanism. let's not get trapped in some kind of passionate opinion stake, right? Let's just go find out what the facts are, and let's see where the facts and the scientific method leads us.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So that, I mean, my own transition has been really moving away from the seven wastes or the eight wastes or whatever, and thinking if you just think of everything as value, if you're only focused on value, waste kind of identifies itself and starts to kind of flake off like, hair on a dog in the springtime, because it begins to open up that idea that why are we paying for this and why are we paying for that? And is actually payment the value proposition that we're looking for? So I've been digging deeper into the kind of, what is value as a, not only as a kind of secular humanistic concept, but as it applies to to all of the things that we do. And I think that's that it's a really good conversation to have. Yep. So you got to Berkeley, and you were and you and Glenn began your really terrific almost 20-year ride now, right? Or almost 30-year ride.
Almost 30 years.
Yes. Yeah, fantastic. And a lot of people came through Berkeley. A lot of people ended up at the University of California at Berkeley looking for a deeper understanding of lean principles and looking to assist in the kind of research things that you guys were accumulating over time. And they are some of our most prolific practitioners in our community. So the first question I have is do you feel kind of like the mother hen of that tribe, or
I don't feel like the mother hen of that tribe.
These aren't your children out there evangelizing for the well. Tell me how you feel about that. I mean, how did the program that you and Glenn had has prospered under your tutelage? How did you begin to find folks who were coming to you for that kind of deeper study?
Yeah, at first, of course, the students that came to Berkeley just came to Berkeley. I mean, they didn't come necessarily for us. And I think that's probably still true today.
I don't know.
A significant part of the attraction is just to come to Berkeley. although nowadays we have more students who say, I've read your papers and I'm interested in lean, and then certainly very much appreciated. But the early students, I'm thinking like, you know, James Chu, came to Berkeley because it was a good school to come to. And we had the fortune with James to work, I mean, not just close together with Glenn and learn about the implementation of the Last Planner system, but we ended up on construction sites. I vividly remember being on top of San Francisco Airport boarding areas A and G with Todd Zabel and his company at the time, Pacific Contracting.
Right.
Because Todd was doing amazing things and implementing Last Planner system in close collaboration with Glenn, detailing the different plies of roofing material and having very specific procedural descriptions on how the material would be put in place, which at the time was revolutionary, right? For as obvious as it is, it was quite revolutionary to spell out the work for the craft workers at that level. So that was very successful. And so we learned a lot from being able to work closely with industry practitioners and have really good conversations about how we can continue to improve work. So James Chu, of course, with Todd, and started Strategic Project Solutions, and the work that they had done got a lot of praise also internationally. And they ended up working on Heathrow Terminal 5, implementing a really full-fledged web-based Last Planner system, and then moved on from there. So timing, of course, is super important.
Todd speaks really fondly of his time at Heathrow. Because he said they were just learning so much every single day. They were just learning all kinds of things, that it was the perfect laboratory for him. And Glenn was there as well, I know. And were you on Heathrow Terminal 5 as well?
I visited, but I was not involved.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So James Chu is one for sure. And he's he's accelerated his learning year after year, and his SPS is doing some amazing things out there in the world. But you've had a bunch of others. Farouk Hamza, for instance, is a buddy of mine up here. Uh-huh. And he's trying to turn the University of Alberta into the Berkeley of the North. Yes. Obviously trying to go deep with those things. And a ton of people, Colin Milberg and Cynthia Zhao, and lots of our friends. Were you there to just kind of help them and guide their research into the PhD, or had you developed a number of things that you were really interested in, and these kids kept feeding in, and they weren't always kids, kept coming to you and saying, "Oh, what do you have for me?" And you directed them in a certain way, or how does the PhD program there that is so famous in our community get started?
So research is always very opportunistic, right? So we have ideas, we talk to people, we read to get inspiration, but then a lot of, especially at the PhD research level, a lot of it has to do with what the student wants to do. And a lot of it has to do in the type of research that I do as to whether we can find industry collaborators. Because, you know, there's only so much work that we can do in computer-based simulation, for example, in virtual design and construction on our computers at the university. Right. We have to go to the gemba, right? We have to be able to hear firsthand what's happening on the ground, and we have to work with people in industry. And we've been very fortunate in Berkeley also to have a wonderful community of practice of lean practitioners who are very open to working on developing new ideas. So, you know, different students come with different interests, and I usually run a number of ideas by them. They often come and they say, oh, I want to work on X, but that's because they've read a paper on X and they think that that's the topic to work on. But then we find out some people are more into computer programming. Other people really don't want to do any computer programming. Some people are very mathematical inclined, like to do simulation or building information modeling, and other students just want to go out and talk to people and are maybe more theoretical in developing models. So I've had the fortune of working with a wide variety of students, which is, I think, part of why there has been so much impact, is because, you know, they have gone out and then worked in so many other different areas than I'm currently working on.
Yeah, so they worked in consulting, they worked in actual construction and design firms, and many of them have gone on to academia as well to continue.
Yeah, so you mentioned Cynthia and Colin, obviously, who work as consultants, basically on the East Coast. A number of academics, Farouk being one of them. I'm thinking also of Thais Alves, of course, at San Diego State. Kristen Parrish at Arizona State. Zofia Rutkowski at Texas A&M.
Yes.
Hyun Woo Lee at the University of Washington, and then there's so many more students. I mean, they've branched out,
and they were brought to you from all over the world as well. It wasn't like they were just Salt Lake City and Chicago. You've really touched international students.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't mention too many of them, but Jan Elfing also is very much stood out. He was one of the early students who looked at supply chain management for electrical switchgear and then went back to Finland. And he's now one of the vice president within Skanska, Finland. And he really was, very dedicated student. So he took so many of the lessons learned to Skanska and began to experiment in Skanska, Finland as to, how do I map out the supply chain for precast concrete elements? And how do I set up a consolidation center for construction work in Helsinki? I mean, he's run a number of experiments, some successful, some not successful, and has learned so much and has moved, forward at such a speed. It's been really amazing.
So you and Glenn set up the Project Production Systems Laboratory, P2SL. At Berkeley, was that an attempt, or no, I assume that was an attempt to get industry involved as well in the kinds of things that you were doing and find placement for experiments out there with industry? Is that a misconception?
It's right, but let me take a step back to give you maybe a richer picture of the history. So, Glenn and Laurie and Greg and others started the International Group for Lean Construction in 1993 because they realized that there were, theoretical gaps in how we managed our project. And then in 1997, just after I had joined the faculty at UC Berkeley, we realized that the number of these theoretical principles and methods really need to be disseminated to industry on a broader basis. And that's what caused us to start the Lean Construction Institute. And then several years later, Glenn and I realized that, yes, the Lean Construction Institute, had a lot of work to do, was doing great work in getting ideas of the last planner system, for example, out to industry. but we ended up with many more questions than were being addressed. And we felt like there really needed to be a strong entity to do research, really focused on research in lean construction. And so in 2005, we started the Project Production Systems Laboratory with that in mind. It was started in part out of need from industry. So a little bit of history on California healthcare projects. We used to have an organization called the Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development, and it was created in California to make sure that the infrastructure available to provide healthcare would be available after a major earthquake. Right. Now, the requirements from OSHPOD really created a lot of havoc among owners of acute healthcare facilities, because they were required to upgrade their facilities, not just to remain standing after an earthquake, but to remain fully functional after an earthquake.
Right.
And so in the early 2000s, more or less, the healthcare owners began to do some capacity planning as to, you know, how many designers do we need to be able to design what's needed here, and how many contractors do we need to be able to do that? And they realized that there just wasn't enough capacity in the market to fulfill the requirements. And so one of the owners, specifically Sutter Health, sort of said, well, we're an important player. I think at the time they had $6 or $8 billion worth of work ahead of them. They said, we're an important player, but in fact, we're dwarfed by some other players in the industry. And there are many more players in the industry than just us. And there just isn't enough capacity. So what are we going to do to get the best designers, the best builders to work for us? And so they stuck their neck out. I think you know the story. They stuck their neck out and they said, well, let's become the owner of choice. Let's figure out what we need to do to be the owner of choice. And that really engaged them in the lean journey. In, you know, rewriting contracts to go from traditional contracts, transactional contracts, to relational contracts. Relictic, of course, was crucial in writing the integrated form of agreement, you know, and so on and so on. So yeah. so that's what started P2SL. So just to complete a thought, the challenge now was that the OSHPOD was kind of the regulatory agency, kind of the bottleneck between the completing the design and starting construction. And OSHPOD would take a long time to do the review, which really was a unique set of imposed a unique set of requirements, system requirements, right? Because you had to make sure that the healthcare facility would perform as a whole. It wasn't just looking at specific parts.
Right.
And what was happening is that because there was so much demand, you know, designers were submitting design documents for review, and OSHPOD would take a certain amount of time. And then that certain amount of time began to increase. And as the amount of time for review began to increase, designers began to say, well, we need to get into the hopper sooner so that we come out sooner. Well, right. That unfortunately was a fallacy, because getting into the design hopper sooner basically meant that the design was less coordinated than it could have been. And because it was less coordinated, it meant that OSHPOD had to spend more time reviewing. And unfortunately, then also realized sometimes after months of being in the hopper that a project had to be sent back for you know, redesign and refinement, and then come back for a second cycle and a third cycle. And so basically the industry was spinning out of control.
Right.
OSHPOD was taking longer, and everybody realized this was a problem, and nobody of their own could really do something about it. And so at the time, you know, Paul Reiser, Sutter, and others talked to Glenn, talked to me about, you know, what can we do about it? And P2SL provided kind of a neutral ground for us to map out what it would take to deliver a 100-bed hospital for OSHPOD as the first customer, not just for construction. And because we were a neutral ground as P2SL, we could actually invite OSHPOD to come and join us in the value stream mapping exercise. And we were very fortunate at the time to have John Gillingerton and others within his organization come and be part of this kind of neutral mapping exercise to really look at how can we solve this industry problem. And that really was the launch of P2SL.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Because I worked at a number of hospitals in California with that had OSHPOD constraints. And it wasn't just the design, it was the equipment. Like if you have an air handler, you had to send it to their shaker table and it had to withstand a Richter 8 scale shaking and still continue going. And I know you had to have, 30 days worth of water. And these were enormous requirements. And people in Iowa would say, well, why does it cost $1,000 a square foot to build a hospital in California? And I said, well, they'd like the hospital to be standing and operating after a Northridge type earthquake, which I think Northridge sparked the OSHPD
regulations.
Yeah, creating that office and having it, not just standing but operating. So, well, that's cool. I didn't know that you guys had actually facilitated some of that to move that along, because that was always a, it's always a dollar figure, and the question is, all delays cost money, as we know, especially in the lean world, all time costs money, and we still face that in administrative reviews for all kinds of things, and that's probably something we should turn our attention to at some point in time.
It's a nice thing, right? My students, and if they're watching, they'll probably smile. I mean, they know that they always complain that the professor is not available to review their work, but part of the review has to do with the quality of the work that's being delivered, and if there's a lot of spelling errors and table of contents that are not properly formatted and with the right page numbers, I get I send work back, and then of course everything takes more time, and it's as if it's my fault. But of course, it has to do more with the lack of implementation of a built-in quality process, which really we should take more to heart.
Sure. I taught environmental law for 10 years at the University of San Diego, and it's just, and even now in my practice, when I have folks that are working for me send me something that. I get distracted by spelling errors and bad grammar, and then I get frustrated. I can't get the idea. I can't get the kernel of the idea that's so important unless they can communicate it.
Yeah. And the same is true in building information models and drawings and anything else, right? So built-in quality is really an important topic, an important concept.
Yeah. And something that people don't think about. And except kind of after the fact, right? It's always QC, which means there has to be rework, and rework is, as you know, one of our big wastes out there. So you've been highly decorated, highly rewarded. You've been highly recognized. That you received the Pioneers Award from LCI, which I thought was terrific. I know that just recently at PPI, you were awarded their outstanding. I can't remember the name of the award, but every year they find somebody who's doing something really amazing and
technical achievement award. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you keep receiving like lifetime achievement awards, because it's hard to pick out, one specific thing, that you've done. Cause I think it's a body of work that's contributed to what we've been doing in the lean world. So as you begin to look back on it, because you do have a fairly significant history with it, how do you feel about that, and what are your next steps? Are you just going to continue on until somehow you fall into a bed of rebar and concrete?
Something like that. probably something like that. I'm very honored to get to have received these awards and to get the recognition. I mean, it is a lifetime of work, as you mentioned. I mean, it has to do a lot with the places I have been and the other people I've had a chance to work with, of course, because that's what lets us make progress, is to put our heads together and together tackle the problem. So I've been very fortunate to have had that opportunity and to continue to have that opportunity to this date. The awards, as they are, though, they are, I think, very much by the lean community. I'm afraid to say that there are still a lot of uphill battles to be fought with the more traditional project management, construction engineering management communities that are slow in changing, if they're changing at all. So I think we have a long ways to go to bring these more systematic and science-based approaches to our community at large.
I've noticed, especially here in Canada, so it's been great to be up here, because I get to look at all of these issues in a 33 million person population rather than 330 million. Mm-hmm. And so I can get very familiar with, lots of people who are acting in the community. And I think that the number one issue with people actually accepting a changed paradigm, number one, people don't mm-hmm. they think of lean as something, well, yeah, we can just kind of do that over here. They don't get the idea that this is a fundamental reinvention of the system and a refocus of how you actually process the built environment. I think the thing that gets in the way of it is the construction companies they're all doing just fine. And they're doing just fine doing all that old stuff that they've been doing forever. And until I think the owners, until the Sutters stand up and say, well, we're not hiring you to do that. We're only hiring you to do, a more thoughtful, more scientific-based approach. We're not looking to negotiate with you on a contract budget that is a win or lose for one of us. We're mm-hmm. looking at trying to figure out what this thing should cost and how long it should take and how we can build it as easily as possible, given the complexity of mm-hmm. all the work that we're doing. So I agree with you. There's a ton of work out there. If you were going to focus the listeners and our community on three or four things, what are the, is there any low hanging fruit, or have we snapped up all the low hanging fruit and now we have just, institutional and fundamental changes that need to be made?
That's a question that was not in the questions that you sent.
It's a big handful. It just came to me. Yeah. I hardly ever send questions out in advance because it's just, it's conversational. When it comes to me, it's like, whoa.
But what you just asked is a big question. the distinction between, low-hanging fruit versus other things to do, I think the lean mindset is really, kind of understanding where you are, where your company is, and then setting out on a journey of continuous improvement. And, in a way, I'll be a little facetious here, but in a way, it doesn't matter how good the competition is. What you want is to just get better yourself. And obviously, for a company to survive, you somehow have to be better than the competition, or at least equal to the competition, in order to be able to right. compete. So you have to have certain strong competences. But I think embarking on a journey of continuous improvement is really the starting place. And I think that comes with a lot of humility, right? It comes with understanding that there's a lot of things that you do that maybe not the best things to do. And then being systematic, and this applies to me as well, no question. And then embarking sort of on a systematic approach to figure out, of all the things that I shouldn't be doing, what can I stop doing and how do I go about that? And then at the same time, all the things that I'm doing well, how can I even do them better? Right. So that should take some of everybody's bandwidth, I think, in terms of how we spend our time. And sometimes we don't have that bandwidth, or we don't want to make it available because we're busy fighting fires and, right. and doing things, that other people want us to do. So it's sometimes very hard to stop the assembly line.
Yeah. So I think that, what that says to me is that all of us need to take the time it takes to do a deep reflection on what do we keep doing, what do we stop doing, and what do we start doing? What are we learning that actually is going to help us out there? And yet we're so busy. The cartoon with the guys with the square wheels on the yes. cart, and the guy who brings up the wheel, and they say, "Well, we don't have time to innovate. We're working here." Is a story that I hear too often. Every week I hear somebody saying, mm-hmm. "Oh yeah, we're doing the best we can, and And I know that they could do better if they just could stop and look at the processes that they're using and take some time to evaluate what they're really doing.
But it's really hard, right? Because the processes that we're doing are intertwined with other people's processes. And so it's really hard on your own to change anything if you have to do things for other people. It's people don't like no as an answer, right? and it is very much as, you know, Greg Howell used to say, is, you know, people in construction and elsewhere have the can-do attitudes, as in, yes, you know, I'll do what you tell me to do, and, you know, I can do it, and let me just go ahead and get it over with.
Right. And, yeah. And
that has its problems.
Yeah. Well, and people will say, well, we have projects to deliver, right? So we don't have time to kind of reinvent this stuff. But I do agree with you that you have to take people where they are. So it is kind of company by company, and I think we can just make, you know, share the knowledge, make the knowledge available, and they can choose to look at it or not. But obviously the evidence is pretty prodigious in favor of moving towards a more evidence-based way of understanding how projects get delivered and taking as many assumptions out of things as possible. Because I think this is one industry where everything is based on assumptions. Mm-hmm. And the fewer assumptions we have, that's what I love about the IPD agreement, is that you get all of the people who are going to be involved in the project on board, and that has to lower some of the level of assumptions that you're making. It's got to be a mitigation of some of the risk.
I like you bringing up the word evidence-based, you know, evidence-based management and the like. I think that's very much where we need to move, is more data collection, right, which now is enabled with so many of the IoT devices that we can implement. And then in addition to data, of course, we need to advance the type of models that we develop so that we can really inform and our understanding and make better decisions as we go along.
Yeah, I've always thought it would be really great to have a national database of priced icons that you could bring 6 feet of a 3/8-inch conduit into your drawing, and it comes with a price, and it comes with a labor burden, basically a kind of factor of a labor burden, so that you could begin to accumulate things. I'm working on a Lego game that is where you have to actually buy the Legos, and the price of them goes up and down, and they all come with a labor burden. And if you buy 17 of one, then your labor burden goes down by 15%, because now you're doing repetitive work. And it's just too complicated.
Well, it's, and you highlighted the complication, right? It's that you really have to do product and process design together. It's about the parts to be put in place, but it's also about how are you going to put these parts in place. And as one changes, the other changes, and there are many possibilities. So it's a really tough problem to design the system for best performance.
Yeah, it really is. It really is at the heart. It's systems thinking. It's not necessarily designed for manufacture or prefab or whatever. It's all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there are some good starting points, you know, for systems thinking in terms of, you know, managing inventories and managing, you know, constraining the work in process and so forth. I mean, there is already a good scientific basis to deploy as a starting point, but we have more to learn.
You just have to dive in and take advantage of it. I'm always surprised by construction companies that do these deep estimates before they start a job, but they never go back with the data that they've actually collected to buff up their estimation system based on what really happened. They just keep going as if that data doesn't matter to them.
And there too, right? The data, I mean, maybe they don't use it because it's inadequate for future use. I mean, you want to tie the data back to not just what was the piece rate for installation, but what methods did we use and what was the context in which we actually did the work, because that of course will affect how effective people can work.
Absolutely.
Did we use tact planning? Did we not use tact planning? Just to give you an example, I think it has a huge impact on how the work can get done.
For sure. All right. So what's next for you? You're just going to continue to plow on until, like I said, you fall into concrete and rebar and they cover you up?
Or maybe get hit by a robot. Hopefully not. But I'm very much into industrialized construction. So I have always enjoyed going to fabrication shops. I take my students to fabrication shops, look at what's happening offsite. I think there's a lot of opportunities, possibilities there to do things differently, right? To not just take work from onsite and do it the same way offsite, but to really rethink how it is done offsite. And robots, automation, of course, provide huge opportunities, although unfortunately also, you know, people might be enticed to invest in technologies that they don't not quite know how to use or that they don't use as well as they can.
Right.
And I think there's huge opportunities there. It's a little bit like our telephones, right? Our cell phones. I mean, they have so many capabilities, for example, for making pictures, but how many of us really know how to know all the adjustments, all the settings for pictures, as opposed to how many just kind of click and take a picture? Right. I do that most of the time. I just click and take a picture.
I'm in that latter group myself. I was thinking how cool it was that, you know, you could leave, you could work on a floor, you could leave at 5 o'clock at night, you could take this Hilti machine that puts all your hangers in according to the, the model, and you show up in the morning and all your hangers are in. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, we should be thinking beyond that. We should be thinking about not having hangers. We should be thinking about how do we get things into buildings without having to do that. So I think that's what you're talking about. How does offsite work actually enhance? Let's just not do offsite what we're doing onsite. Let's do something, you know, really imaginative. Well, I appreciate you taking the hour with us. It's time has just flown by. Any last words that you want to leave out there? Any words of wisdom? I mean, you are the wise one. That's a lot of pressure.
I mean, maybe a quick comment on, you know, as having been recognized as a pioneer, I hope there will be many more people entering our field of lean construction, for one thing, but especially I think it'd be nice to have even more women join our field of lean construction. I think we don't have enough women in the field. And I think lean construction has many, at least to me, appealing features that make it more attractive to enter the industry than other features of other sectors of our industry, to put it mildly. Yeah. I think I've been fortunate to work with a number of, you know, brilliant young women and back to the students who have graduated, you know, who are making a change in the industry. And I hope there will be many more brilliant young women as well as brilliant young men. But certainly we need more women so we can change the balance in the industry.
Well, and with your help, we'll introduce the listeners to some of those brilliant women who have been really important in moving things forward as you see it. So thank you so much for your time. You're obviously the king woman in our community. So thank you so much, Iris. It's been great. And thanks for your service over the years.
Thank you so much, Dick. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.